You know, there's some downsides to peacemaking. When you get involved in resolving conflict, there's all sorts of problems that can surface. I'm going to show a little video clip here about one particular dynamic you need to be prepared for.
Hi, my name is Ted.
Hi, Ted.
Yeah, well, this is my first time here.
It's okay, Ted.
No shame, brother.
Just be honest, Ted.
Thanks. So anyway, like I said, my name is Ted, and I'm a peacemaker. I started peacemaking about 5 years ago, you know. Oh, at first it was just a couple times, you know, nothing big, just a little encouragement to a coworker, or maybe a confrontation with a family member. Nothing major.
That's all right, Ted. We're all with you.
Thanks. Anyway, I guess I should start where it all began. Like I said, it was about 6 years ago. Everything was normal. And then one day I was reading my Bible, you know, part of my quiet time. I mean, I had a quiet time every day, 10 minutes of Bible reading, 5 minutes of prayer. It made me feel better. I had no idea it would eventually lead to this, where I am today.
Oh, we've all been there, Ted. Keep going. You're doing great.
Yeah, thanks. Anyway, I had this Bible with all the cross references, you know, the verses that would lead you to other verses about the same subject, and turn back to Matthew 5:24, you know.
Not that verse.
The part about being reconciled to your brother, and then Galatians 6, bear one another's burdens, and then on to 1 John. And hey, let me tell you something. If you're out there tonight and you don't want to end up like me, stay away from 1 John.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the real stuff. That's not diluted, you know. 1 John said, if anyone hates his brother, he walks in darkness. And then it hit me. Oh, sure, there was lots of times it didn't show, but I knew it was in my heart. Times that I didn't forgive, that I held a grudge rather than doing what Jesus said.
Yo, been there, done that, Ted. Let it all out, babe.
Yeah, well, like I said earlier, start out slow. You know, I just figured a little apology now and then wouldn't hurt. So that morning after my quiet time, I saw my wife. And I apologized for raising my voice the night before. And then I saw my daughter getting ready for school, and I asked her forgiveness for not being more involved in her life. Oh, man, what a rush! Couldn't believe it. I never felt anything like it before.
Yeah.
So anyway, the next day, the good vibes starts wearing off.
Yeah.
I mean, I was at work. I couldn't run home and go and do a reconciliation or an apology there, huh?
Yeah.
So what did I do? That's when I started my exhibitionism.
Oh, yeah,
I started doing it in public. Oh, it was all innocent enough. I went up to Mike and I told him the more I thought about our argument, the more I realized that I was wrong. Oh, it happened again. Woo! That rush for freedom. Well, before long, I was actually planning and scheduling conversations with people and that I knew I'd offended. But not even that was enough after a while. I started to talking to people I knew I hadn't offended, but I could tell they were upset with me for some reason. Yeah. Oh, and the rush and the adrenaline just increased with every step. It was unbelievable. And then one day I hear about this guy in our church is leaving his wife. I mean, what does that have to do with me, right? I mean, that was this guy's life. That was his mess. He hadn't offended me. I hadn't offended him. There was nothing I should do about it. I went to talk with this guy. Oh, we talked. We talked, we cried, we yelled. We met several times, and finally, before long, he started doing it too. Yeah. Yeah, you know, getting his kicks from reconciliation. I knew then I needed help, and that's why I came to Peacemakers Anonymous.
We're glad you did, Chad. We're here to help you.
Well, yeah, thanks. So I guess what I'm saying is I want to be cured, you know. I want my old life back. I want to live like a zombie again.
Yeah.
I want my relationships on a surface level. No deep emotions. I want to stop being moved with compassion and understanding every other hour.
Yeah.
I want to stop crying and feeling sympathy for other people. I got to stop this. Just give me my job, my family, my middle class lifestyle, 2.5 kids, a minivan, a dog, a garage, and 2 cars.
Oh.
I'm tired of this face stuff. It makes me feel so dependent. So much like I've got to act on what I believe.
Amen.
So anyway.
Oh.
I'm tired of this faith stuff. It makes me feel so dependent. So much like I've got to act on what I believe. So anyway, I guess that's why I'm here. With your help, maybe I can go through the 12 steps. Get back to normal Christianity again.
All right, Ted. Thanks.
We have to be able to laugh at ourselves. That's Charlie Jones. Charlie and Ruth Jones have a drama group called Peculiar People, and they did a appropriately named. You should look them up on the web. They've got some incredible, incredible drama where they present the gospel. They just capture biblical truth so profoundly. And that one's just one we use in our seminars just to lighten things up a bit. Because peacemaking is sort of heavy stuff at times. Those vignettes are all included in our small group study. So when people are going through this material in a small group setting, so when people go through the material, they can have some humorous things, some serious things, and really connect at the heart level. Well, last night we talked about a vision for building a culture of peace. And there's sort of two things you can look at as you learn to be more effective as a peacemaker. One is developing actual skills that you can use when people come to you and they're in conflict. In fact, better yet, when you're in a conflict, how you can live these things out, practice them, make them a part of your life. But then secondly, how can you, and this is actually to us the more important thing, how can you help prepare other people, even an entire church, to deal with conflict before it arises? This is literally an area where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. As a church weaves peacemaking into the day-to-day life, into the fabric, into the culture of a congregation, day in and day out, it's already there, built into the DNA of the church. So when conflict erupts, that congregation is ready to deal with conflict in a constructive way. And let me give you an illustration of a very common scenario that comes to our ministry where having a culture of peace, not just some skills you pull out on occasion, but a congregation that is deeply committed to peacemaking in advance. You turn to page 11 in your study guide. It's my page 11. I'm not sure how it's numbered in your book, but it says opportunity number 3, a conflict you can't hide or ignore. And this is a scenario that many churches face. A young woman goes off to school, meets a boy, ends up pregnant out of wedlock. This is an actual case that I was working on. She comes home, decides not to abort the baby, thank God. The young man follows her home. He wants to continue the relationship with her. Her parents are not at all enthused about this relationship. They blame this young man for ruining their daughter's life. But he ends up coming to church. He's not a believer, but he is interested in pursuing the relationship. So now the parents are in an awkward spot. So they tell this young man, no, don't come to church. Well, that's not a very godly thing to do. So they're wrestling, and the church leaders are starting to get some heat because this young woman ends up, you know, comes to church, and here's this nice, handsome young man at her side. She's pregnant. Other young girls are looking at this and trying to, what's going on? Finally, she has the baby. Now she's showing up with this cute little baby in a baby carrier, young man at her side, and all the teenage girls at church are coming up and oohing and aahing about the little baby. What does the church do? What message is this sending? Unfortunately, to many people, it will send the message, this is a way to get a baby and a man, is get pregnant. And there's a lot of young women that can get that message. So what happens in many churches, in the church I was working with, pardon me, this is exactly what happened. Two factions develop. You call them the truth faction and the grace faction. The truth people want to make sure that they send a clear message. It's a sinful behavior. We don't condone it. We need to make an example of her. Well, that's not really a constructive thing to do if you don't handle it properly. There's also the grace faction. They say, well, who are we to judge others? Let the first who's without sin cast the first stone, pulling all these nice verses out of context, and just saying, let's just, you know, live and let live, forgive, and hopefully our acceptance will bring this young man, Alex, to Christ. So here's the leaders caught between these two factions. What do they do? And this is something where many, I've consulted with a lot of churches who misstep either too much in the grace direction, where they do nothing, they're just accepting and kind, or they come down in such a harsh way they drive the young couple from the church, the family from the church, disillusion a lot of other people. It's a very fine line to walk. And this is where pastoral leadership comes to play. The leaders in the church, the pastors, the elders, people of influence, counselors such as yourself, can play a key role in guiding this couple and even impacting an entire congregation as they go through a conflict that has a public component. It can't be contained. It's an issue, a situation that people know about. Now, as I've worked with leaders over the past 27 years, I've found that there's sort of two harmful styles leaders can often fall into as they're dealing with conflict in a church. One is what we call the people-pleasing style. And there's a lot of leaders in the church today whose primary agenda is just keeping everybody happy. And so they're very agreeable. Their motto is sort of fire. What fire? There's no conflict. Don't make a big deal about it. They tend to deny the existence of conflict, play it down. Very often, leaders that are inclined in this direction wrestle with fear of man. They're more concerned about the opinions of other people than they are about God's opinion. They often lack training in peacemaking because they don't know what to do. They're very uncertain. And men in particular, I found, if they don't think they'll succeed at something, they don't want to venture in the first place. You cannot get me in a golf course. I cannot hit a golf ball. And if I know I'm going to fail, why go out there and try? Well, that's how a lot of leaders are. If they haven't been trained, they're not going to get engaged because they're just afraid of failing. They tend to deny the existence of conflict, to minimize it, pacify it. And very often, if they're going to try to counsel somebody and address an issue, they'll often try to do it through the pulpit. They'll do a sermon designed for one particular person, and unfortunately, that person is often sleeping through the sermon, and everyone else is sitting there saying, was that for me? Was that for me? Well, in fact, every sermon should be for everybody in the room. But if you need to talk to somebody about a particular issue in their life, counseling through the pulpit is really a coward's way out. So very often, these leaders have a lot of unresolved offenses. They build up like tinder in a forest. If you don't have a fire that burns through a forest regularly and takes out the tinder, you can actually have good forest fires up in Montana. If you have regular fires in the forest, it doesn't kill the tree. It just burns out the tinder and moves on. In the same way, conflict can bring issues to the surface. You can deal with them, resolve them, and it doesn't have to kill things. But if you don't deal with conflict, the kind of people-pleasing leaders, things will build up and build up and build up, and finally it will explode, and there's a whole combination of conflicts that come to the surface at once. The other kind of extreme that you run into in leaders often is what we call the controlling leader, and their motto is fight fire with fire. They take a very aggressive approach to dealing with conflict. They tend to wrestle with issues of pride. They're self-absorbed. They know what's going on. They've got all the answers. They're very self-confident people. They tend to be slow to listen. They're not really hearing people. I've sat in mediations with these kind of leaders, and you can tell the whole time the other person is talking, instead of listening to understand, the leader is just planning his rebuttal. He's just getting ready to come back with his agenda. He's like an attorney in a courtroom. There's often a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering, and unfortunately there's some polities and churches that really lend themselves to politicking and maneuvering behind the scenes. And it's just incredible to see what Christians will do along those lines. A controlling leader tends to move to eliminate opposition, to build factions of support, and often wants to keep the appearance of unity, even though the church is very deeply polarized beneath the surface. But if they keep this veneer, that pastor feels successful. Conflicts, a controlling leader can suppress conflicts for a long time. Just keeps putting them out, suppressing them. But eventually resentments build up, factions start to develop underneath them. And I've seen many of these leaders just suddenly just swept aside. They're there in power one day. It seems like they're very, very strong, very much in power. And then suddenly they are just swept aside as things build up over them. Those are obviously not good ways to deal with conflict. Now, the sad thing is, we see those dynamics not only in the church, we see them in ministries, you see them in the corporate world, you even see them in families. You've got parents who tend to be sort of child-pleasing parents or controlling parents, and those tensions go on. As I shared last night, my wife and I do tend in those opposite directions, and we need to balance each other out to help each other see our weaknesses in those areas. So what's the way to deal with this? If you're a leader in the church, you're dealing with a difficult conflict, like this scenario we started with, the scenario or the role that I counsel people to follow is the example of a shepherd. Now, the shepherd metaphor has been denigrated in our time. There's a lot of very negative pictures. For a time, there was a whole religious movement called the shepherding movement of extreme control. That term shepherd was badly misused. So some people shy away from the metaphor. We had a long talk about this in our ministry, and we just Agreed. It is a strong, powerful biblical metaphor. It's one that we think we need to recapture. In fact, I want to commend to you a book by Tim Laniak. He's a professor at Gordon-Conwell. And he lived for a year with the Bedouin shepherds in the Middle East to really understand this. He's written a book called While Shepherds Watch Their Flock, Superb Insights on Pastoral Shepherding Care. It applies to parents, anybody in a counseling position, particularly church leaders. But I want to talk about two ways that this shepherding metaphor can counterbalance this people-pleasing, controlling tendency. Now, and the reason I teach it here is, first of all, I think each of us needs to be aware of our own propensities. Are we inclined to move this way or this way so we can counteract it? Just as when you're driving a car, if your brakes tend to pull to the left, if you know that, you can counteract it and steer to the right. So understanding yourself, what is my tendency? Am I a people pleaser? Am I a controller? But then secondly, as you work in churches, you will often get involved with someone in conflict and someone in leadership. Counselors are often in positions of being mediators and facilitators and supporters for people in conflict. And as you go to church leaders, trying to assess where they're coming from so you can help them counterbalance some of their tendencies. Now, that's delicate because a lot of church leaders won't want you coming and assessing them and guiding them and telling them. So you often have to be very subtle and even practice some of the very shrewd counseling leadership dynamics that we see in the Bible. There's a lot of shrewd conduct that goes on in the Bible. I'll just give you a simple example of how to approach a leader in a shrewd way. We're to be innocent as dove, as shrewd as serpents. A woman after a seminar came to me and she said, Ken, my pastor desperately needs this training. He's a wonderful man. He preaches well. He loves our people. But he just doesn't know how to deal conflict. And he steps on people's toes and he just offends them and drives them away. And I'd love to have him learn what you're teaching. The trouble is, he only reads and studies and listens to people in a very small circle of people he respects. And I doubt he's ever heard of you. You're not in our denominational background. I don't think he'll even read your book. And so I asked her a few more questions, and she validated the fact he's a caring, compassionate, sincerely motivated pastor, as most pastors are. And so I suggested a slightly different way. Instead of going to him and saying, Pastor, you really need to read this, which in a way is a criticism, saying you're weak in this area. Instead, I said, why don't you try this? Go to him and say, Pastor, I was at a seminar last week, and I heard some really interesting things that I'm still trying to sort through, and I'm trying to assess, you know, how biblical they are. Are these really things consistent with our teaching? And I wonder if you would read this book and critique it for me and let me know what you think of it. And it turns out she called me a few weeks later, said he was happy to do it. He was happy to critique something, but he didn't want to read it where he needed to be the one being instructed. Now, that woman approached him really in the same spirit like Abigail and Esther. You see women in the Bible very often as they're dealing with someone in authority above them take an indirect approach. There's a fine line between, you know, that kind of thoughtful engagement and manipulation. You have to really pray for wisdom there. But it is a way that you, as a counselor in a church, are going to have to find wise, gracious, humble, respectful ways to engage leaders who often are not doing a very good job dealing with conflict. And the attitude I always encourage you to have is one of respect and submission. They are there by God's design, in His providence, that person is leading the church. So you want to come alongside them, minister to them, encourage them. So specifically, how do you deal with these two tendencies to be a people pleaser or a controller? Well, first of all, to counteract the tendency to be a controller, the thing that I see there is to pray that God would help us to imitate Jesus, to put on the humility and the compassion of a Christ-like shepherd, so that serving people is actually more rewarding, more fulfilling, more delightful than controlling them. It's basically say, Lord, change my appetites. By my sinful nature, I derive safety and fulfillment and pleasure from controlling things. Help me to put that to death and instead trust you to be the one who's controlling, and I'm a channel of your grace, and my joy is to serve people. That's where I'm rewarded. So it's not just a decision to change in your technique. It's to say, God, transform my heart so that I would find delight in having the compassion and servant's heart of a shepherd. As you grow in this area and pray for God's grace and deliberately work at developing some Christ-like characteristics, some of these are just self-sacrificing, laying down your rights, your agenda, your approach, and saying, Lord, your way is the right way. How can I serve other people? An attitude of gentleness. of being gentle with people, not overly forceful, of being approachable, where your nature is winsome, gracious, it's safe to talk to you. Often talking to pastors about being approachable, it's a very frequent, delicate dance I do as I work with pastors, is this whole concept of approachability. There's a I've got a web link on our page here. I strongly encourage you to go to that page, download that article. It's something we've developed over the years for church leaders. There's whole denominations that have handed that out to all the pastors saying we need to cultivate this quality. Approachability simply means cultivating the kind of demeanor and character, reputation, and relationships where people feel comfortable and safe coming to you, that they can come to you with problems, with ideas, even with correction and criticism, and they know they're not going to be rebuffed, criticized, or condemned for that. It's a very important quality to have in a leader. Let me just give you a practical example of where this comes out. I had another case where a pastor called me up, and they had one of these out-of-wedlock pregnancy cases, and it was an elder's daughter. So it just really created some tensions. The elder and his wife were very protective of the daughter, understandably. Others in the church thought that because she was the daughter of a leader that they even had to be firmer with her just to show they weren't practicing favoritism. And so the elder board was being sort of directed in the moving in the direction, being pretty hard. And as the pastor described what they did, what they were doing, I just sort of flinched. And they were going to demand her to stand in front of the congregation. She had not really come to a point of repentance. She was still working through issues in her own life. There's a lot of areas, and they were just sort of behind her, pushing her along pretty hard. And so what I did is I asked the pastor, I said, you know, do you have your Bible on your desk? And he did. I said, would you open it to Isaiah 40:11 and read that to me? And what that verse says, to me this is a premier shepherding passage. It says he tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those who have young. And I said, Ray, if this young woman came across that verse in her devotions today, would she say, that's exactly how my pastor is ministering to me today? And there was a long silent spell, and he said, I don't think so. I said, well, maybe the starting point in ministering to her is to go to her and ask her forgiveness for not shepherding her with the love and the tenderness of Christ. Now, he later told me that was a very hard thing to do for him because he's proud. He has this vision that leaders don't say they're sorry, they're confident. But as he prayed about it, talked to his wife about it, she helped him to see that was the right thing to do. And he went to the girl and he confessed to her. And she just dissolved in tears. She was longing. She was longing for the pastor to gently guide her through this. She was longing for someone who would take her up close and guide her through this very, very traumatic situation. But he had handled her so roughly, she didn't feel safe coming up. And you think of that metaphor. He shepherds his flock, he tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. It's bullseye for that situation. It's also bullseye for me as a father. Every day as I engage my wife, as I engage my children, as I engage the people in my ministry, as I work as an elder in my church, it's a wonderful metaphor and picture for us to keep in mind. Anytime we're dealing with people who are in some way dependent upon our care. And that situation did resolve itself very well, praise be to God. But there's another tendency. We can go so far in the tender, kind, gentle direction that we become indulgent, that we become fearful of people, we become people pleasers. And the way we counteract that tendency, again, is by imitating Christ. Christ is the thorough, comprehensive, well-balanced, perfect man. And he has in himself all the characteristics we need, both to counteract a controlling tendency, but also to counteract a sinful, people-pleasing tendency. And so we say, Lord, help me to imitate Jesus, to put on the strength and the courage of a shepherd. Shepherds guard their flocks by night. And they've got weapons out there, and they fight for their sheep. And they have to stand up, and sometimes those silly, stupid sheep have to be opposed and disciplined and grabbed and whacked with a rod. All sorts of things a shepherd has to do when necessary. And so we need to pray to God to give us that kind of strength and courage, so that pleasing God and protecting the flock is more important than pleasing people. And I've been delighted to see some pastors who I knew had been in ministry for years, who'd been just very weak in their leadership, did not have courage to stand up, and by God's grace were transformed into people who could stand up, look people in the eye, speak the truth in love, and deal with difficult issues. One of the keys here is essential, I mean, most of all, is prayer. Just God, transform me. Give me the character of Christ. Jesus can transform anybody. But then also, specifically, is to develop a very principled approach to dealing with issues. If you just have very nebulous, fuzzy-wuzzy values, well, people should get along, we should live at peace, we should love each other, you know, those are so nebulous, it's really hard to get concrete guidance. And that's where developing a very thorough, practical theology for conflict resolution, for counseling, all those things is good. You can go back to those principles and say, what does God's Word say? His guidance is clear, and here's how I need to carry it out. A pastor who has this kind of skill or a counselor or leader of any kind is going to be able to speak the truth in love, is willing to confront, to do it gently but firmly, and is willing to exercise redemptive church discipline. As I said last night, briefly in my talk and then in the workshop, biblical redemptive church discipline is one of the most underused ministries in the church today. And it's one that our ministry is very committed to trying to reinvigorate churches on, to see that this is one of the most loving, gracious things they can do, is to help churches redeem or practice redemptive discipline. A shepherd leader, trust God, is always up to something good. So when conflict comes up, you can say, let's use this fire for good. And fire can be used for good. I used the picture earlier where forests can, if they're burned out the right time, the right way, it kills the dead wood. You have a more lush forest, can be very, very good. The same thing in life. Conflict brings things to the surface. It melts us, exposes sin, gives us opportunity to grow. Even as Tim's testimony last night, just as sin was revealed in their lives through conflict in their relationship, God was redeeming. He was refining. He was helping them to grow. And that's a good thing. The qualities we need to cultivate to be more shepherd-like in our ministry to people is, number one, always delighting in the gospel. That is our greatest joy and delight. That's the first thing on our lips. It's the first thing we think about. Very skilled at listening. And this is hard for some people to do. Some people are naturally good listeners, some are not, but it's a skill that can be improved, but it just takes discipline to focus, to think. As an attorney, I have this tendency to be practicing my rebuttals while people speak, and I have to consciously push that aside. When I catch myself doing that, is to say, okay, put that aside. Try to understand, what is she really saying? How do I really interpret this? And that takes work. It's a deliberate process. Years ago, I read an article in Time magazine. It's called "Of Poets and Engineers." It was actually quite an insightful article. It talks about people, you know, there's sort of two general categories of personality types in terms of communication. Poets tend to speak in broad, sweeping terms. Engineers, like me, that was my background before I went into law, I'm an engineer, they tend to be very precise. And my wife is more poetical, and I'm more precise. So when we have a conflict on something issue, she might say something like, oh, you never, I don't know, there's lots of things I never do. But she might say, you know, you never lead the children in devotions. I say, now, honey, that's not true. 3 weeks ago, Wednesday afternoon, I did lead them one time. And I'll go after that word never, and I'll attack the inaccuracy of that broad sweeping term. And I'll bring my lawyering precision engineering skills to attack and undermine or discredit her, impeach her witness, and show I'm right. I do sometimes. I win the case. Walk away. Now, if I work at listening and I hear that word never, I go, that's not true. It's not that I never do it. In fact, I even do it 49% of the time. But what I say is, now hold on, what is she really saying? What she's really saying is not that I never do it. She's saying that she doesn't think I'm as consistent as I should be. That there's room for growth. That by God's grace I can improve. And that's a statement I can agree with. And say, Corlette, that's true. If what you're saying is this, it's true. I can grow in that area. So it takes work, and it takes suppressing our sinful tendency to defend ourselves, to blame, but we can develop that skill. We can develop the skill of drawing people out, asking questions, understanding their concerns, building genuine agreement and cooperation. For a peacemaking leader, success in a conflict is defined not in terms of just getting everybody back in their seats and having the appearance of unity again, but it's truly reconciled people whose relationships are better now than they were before the conflict erupted. They're growing in Christ-like character, and they've arrived at agreements that they will stand behind. They have a sense of ownership in, because they weren't forced on them. They actually had a role in those forming those agreements. Now, when you practice these kinds of things in a church, when you live them out in your life, when you encourage this in the people you have influence over, when you do what you can to pray for the leaders in your church and encourage them and model, and as God gives you opportunities even to sort of teach these things to leaders, there's so many things can happen in a church that are so beneficial when you have peacemaking leaders. Number one, leaders can recapture their vision and their passion for pastoral ministry. There's so many people that go into ministry with very great ideals and goals, and they get so disillusioned when they deal with all the sinners and the conflict and the backstabbing. But when they learn how to respond to it in a constructive, loving way, it can really bring back that initial joy they had in pastoral ministry. Marriages and friendships can stay together. The turnover rate in the church can be decreased, and particularly divorce rates can be lowered. One of my personal goals before I retire, I would love to see some of the major metro areas we're working in, Dallas, Texas, an example. I would love to see us be able to document and show the churches that are practicing biblical peacemaking, building a culture of peace, can show actual evidence that they have dramatically reduced the divorce rate. Because I'll tell you, folks, if we're doing our job, living out the gospel in our churches, you should be able to take a survey of a congregation like the one that lives here in this church, in the culture at large in Escondido, and you should show this marked difference. You could have two. My vision is a full-page ad in the paper with two bar graphs. Divorce rate in Escondido in general, divorce rate in the churches that follow Jesus Christ and believe in the gospel. And there are people out there that would be drawn to a church because they want that environment. They want that support. They know they need it. Another benefit of this is that people can learn how to resolve their conflicts personally and privately instead of always coming to the leadership. They're starting to live it out in a very practical way in their own lives. Peace and reconciliation begin to permeate an entire congregation, and it can stimulate church growth, actually draw people to that church who want to be part of that kind of relational environment. And as I talk to pastors, I often point them to Ephesians 5:27 and Revelations 21, where it talks about this goal of presenting the church to Christ as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. That's a beautiful image for us as leaders in the church. How do we clean the bride up? How do we sew up the rents in her garments and patch up the bruises and present her to Christ as a peaceful, loving, united church? And one way that happens is through our work as shepherds, whatever role God gives to us. I want to go back to that case we started with Connie and Alex. The church, this is on page 14, the leaders in that church had developed a culture of peace. For many, many years, they were teaching, practicing these biblical principles. Their whole congregation was committed to it. They worked for a long time with the young woman, with Connie, we'll call her Connie, and her parents, working through their issues, helping her parents to have a more loving attitude toward Alex, the young man. And they began to just have a closer relationship working together instead of opposing each other. One of the other elders was working with the young man, Alex, building a relationship with him, teaching him about Christ, sharing the gospel. And he came to Christ. After a few months, he professed faith in Christ. So the walls were slowly coming down. Connie and her parents were more reconciled. Her parents were more open to Alex. They still weren't really enthused about him marrying their daughter. He didn't have a college degree. He didn't have ways that they thought he could support her very well. So they had apprehensions there. So there's still some tension, undecided issues. But shortly after Alex's conversion, the elders, as they ministered to this young couple, persuaded them that the right thing to do was to stand up and give a public confession. An out-of-wedlock pregnancy is not a private matter. Now, if this couple had just been involved sexually, was not pregnant, was repentant, they could have dealt with it privately and would have been just fine. But because she was pregnant, because there were people looking and wondering and questioning what was going on, it was a public sin in a sense that people knew about it. And so Alex and Connie both agreed it would be appropriate to make a public statement. And I was at the church the day they did this. They called a special congregational meeting right after the worship service for members. And I actually think they should have done it for the whole congregation, because even visitors, I think, would have been blown away. And Alex and Connie both got up and gave some of the most powerful testimonies I've ever heard in my life, talking about the grace of God, the redeeming power of Christ, and the effect of the gospel in their lives. And Connie got up first, since she'd been a member of the church, and she gave her testimony, confessed her sin, thanked God for his forgiveness, acknowledged how much she had hurt her parents, how much that grieved her, how thankful she was for the gospel, the hope she had in him. By now she had the baby, this cute little boy that was there, and she was thankful for him. But she said, I want to tell you, and I want to speak especially to the teenage girls here in the audience, this is not the way to have a baby. And she went into about a 10-minute description of her life and how it had been forever changed. She had to drop out of college. She was working a job. Her mother was raising her little boy most of the time. She was missing out on the joy of being there for a lot of what moms want to be there for. She said, this is not the way to do it. And at that time, she wasn't even sure if she and Alex were going to get married. So she said, I'm not sure if my little boy is going to have his mother and father together. So she gave a powerful exhortation to the young people in that church about the downside, about the consequences of sexual engagement outside of marriage. It was compelling. Alex got up and gave a very similar testimony, confessed his sin, his deep grief over what he'd done. Thank God that through this, however, he led him to Christ. Thank for the leadership in the church. And he gave a similar exhortation to the young men. And he talked about the selfishness of his sexual lust, how he was looking out for his own pleasure. This wasn't love. This was lust. It was wrong. It was sinful. I've changed the lives of many people. I've hurt many people. So he gave a similar exhortation to the young men. As I listened to them, I thought, a pastor couldn't do 10 sermons that would have the impact that these two testimonies had on these young people. Very powerful. And the good news was that about a month after that, after praying a long time, Connie's parents finally agreed that it would be right and good for them to get married. They gave their blessing to that relationship. That couple was married. They're doing very well in that church. Respected, honored, loved. Their sin has not marked them as being second-class Christians. They are under the grace of Jesus Christ. In fact, she's expecting their second child here in just a few weeks. Powerful evidence of God's grace. And they have a very powerful ministry to the youth in that church as they go on and talk to young people dealing with issues of sexuality, relationship, marriage, and so on. They're speaking out of that experience to them. So if a church has a culture of peace where that kind of a process is expected, the people are comfortable with it, they know the results are positive and redemptive, it's just part of the church. And as I was, I had my children there for that meeting, and as we were driving home, I turned to them, they were both teenagers at the time, and I said, what'd you learn today? And my daughter Megan said, whoa, Dad, I learned you don't get sexually involved until you get married. I said, good, good, I'm glad you heard that. And I said to my son, Jeff, I said, Jeff, what did you learn? He says, Dad, I learned there is no sin so bad that God can't forgive it. And isn't that great? Because Satan would love to have us think that there's some sin that's just so bad, that's it, we've gone beyond his grace, give up, we're lost, we're hopeless, just bag it. And to see that people can be redeemed even from public sins like that. Well, how do we teach a congregation to live out those principles? Let me quickly go into this next aspect of developing a practical theology and teaching it to an entire congregation. One of the things that I've learned as I've talked to many church leaders, many people who go through seminary, even in counseling programs, there's a lot of places you can go and get a degree, an advanced degree, either in as being a pastor or being a counselor, and not get practical skills on conflict resolution. And it still amazes me. And I talk to a lot of people in seminaries, and I've just talked to many presidents of seminaries who admit they don't have practical teaching on conflict resolution. And when I push them and say, don't you think this is a pretty vital skill for a pastor or anyone you graduate to have? And they'll acknowledge it and say, so why don't you change it? And he says, well, everybody's got their turf. The homiletics guys don't want to give up any of their credits, and these guys don't want to give up theirs, and there's all this staked out territory for the curriculum, and there seems to be no room for practical theology of conflict resolution. And yet it is a life-changing skill to have. So I want to just share with you a very simple process that you can learn and teach, and it's included in this little brochure, and I hope you all get one of these brochures before you leave, because it gives you some practical guidance on how to do this. You can summarize all these principles in this. Let me hit just a few of the high points of it. Number one, we need to understand how conflict evolves. What are our natural tendencies? And here's this slippery slope diagram again, and it's broken down a little more specifically on how we, just as individuals, tend to respond to conflict. We call this the slippery slope. And it's got three main zones, the escape responses, and this tends to be where people pleasers tend to go, is over here, people pleasers. We've got the attack responses, that tends to be where controlling people tend to go. And up on top is these peacemaking responses. Now, the escape responses, there's three primary dynamics there. One is just denial. We pretend like there isn't a conflict. We just ignore it. We're blind to it. Another one is flight. We just get away from that relationship as quickly as we can. And then the most extreme response is suicide, where people actually attempt to take their lives just because the conflict is so great. And suicide, depending on which report you read, it's either the third or fourth leading cause of death among American adolescents. It's a very serious problem in our culture today, but it's also a big culture in many other societies, too. Japan has a terrible suicide rate today. People actually meet each other through the web. They've never met before, and they plan group suicides in Japan. It's just, there's no purpose for life. They're just totally lost. So that's what we call the peace-faking response over there on that side, the escape responses. We pretend like there's peace when there's not. Example of that, just in a simple way, is, you know, if I come home at the end of the day, I walk in and say hi to my wife. How you doing, Corlette? And she says, just fine. And I go, well, that's good. I'll be on the shop for a while. Now, that is both denial and flight. I know there's something going on. Her words said she's fine, but her tone of voice clearly sent another message. But I don't want to deal with it, so I just pretend like I just heard her words, and I just get out of there. And that's denial and flight. I'm escaping instead of saying, hey, sit down, let's talk, what happened, what's going on? And so we need to be willing to engage. But the other extreme on the attack responses is we can have assault. Now, sometimes our ministry has actually dealt with physical assault within churches and ministries. It's never ceases to amaze me how the board of directors of a Christian parachurch ministry can devolve into a fist fight, but it's happened. But the typical way we assault in the church is not with the fist. How do we assault each other? Yeah, with the tongue. It's deadly, a restless evil. A single spark sets a whole forest on fire. And so there's so many ways we attack with the tongue. Litigation is another attack response. We are the most litigious society in the world. The United States has 200 times more attorneys per capita than Japan does. 200 times. We are an incredibly rights-oriented culture. Now, there's a time to access the courts. I thank God for the American legal system. In spite of all its deficiencies, I still think it's the best in the world. But there's some significant weaknesses, and especially when Christians are using litigation against other Christians when we should be going to our church. That would be the preferable way. And then murder is another response, attack response. And what I found is you know, we even had a case one time where a pastor was murdered. He was counseling a woman. Her husband didn't like it. He went into the office and shot the pastor. The more typical murder we have, though, is what we see described in 1 John 3:15. If you hate your brother in your heart, you're a murderer. And there's a lot of Christians who sit in church on Sunday mornings, and they are murdering the pastor in their hearts, even as he preaches the gospel. And that's a serious sin, to sit there harboring bitterness and resentment and anger and hatred towards somebody. And so we need to help people get off those edges and up into this middle zone. And there's six basic responses up there that we try to encourage people to look at. Overlooking minor offenses, reconciling personal offenses through confession, loving confrontation, and forgiveness, negotiating material issues. Should we hire the youth pastor? Should we get a new car? Can our daughter wear that dress to school? Those are material substantive issues that we have to learn how to negotiate in a godly way. And if we can't resolve those things, what we call personal peacemaking, we move into what we call assisted peacemaking, three on this side, and that's mediation, arbitration, and accountability or discipline. And that's where the church gets involved. That's where people with your training would get involved in that assisted zone when people can't resolve a conflict. So let me talk about some basic principles you can apply as you are either coaching people through a conflict, helping them to live out these personal responses, and in many cases you will be conflict coaches, where someone comes to you with a problem, they've got an issue with another person, they don't want you to solve it for them, but they want some help and advice and encouragement and counsel on how they can go back and do it. We call that conflict coaching. You would call it counseling. And what are some techniques you can use, whether you're coaching or whether you might actually sit down with both parties and have them both in the room and you're working them through this conflict they've got in their marriage, their business, with their children, whatever. The system that we've developed over the years, we call the four G's, four basic principles under which you can organize the biblical teaching on conflict resolution. First is to glorify God, and we're going to spell these out in more detail in just a minute. Second, get the log out of your own eye. And third is to gently restore the other person. Four is to go and be reconciled. There's a progression here, focusing first on God. Secondly, what's my contribution to the conflict? Third, how can I help the other person see his or her contribution? And finally, how can we bring it all together in true reconciliation in good, just, appropriate solutions? So let's unpack those just a little bit. Glorifying God by using conflict to reconcile or to reflect his reconciling love. We talked about this last night. When we're in a conflict, we have the opportunity to be like a mirror where people look at us and they see the compassion and grace and glorious forgiveness of Jesus reflected off us into their lives. And that's one of the best witnesses Christians will often have, even to the unsaved in the workplace and our neighborhoods, is that when they're in a conflict with us or they see us in a conflict with someone else, as they watch us, they would be saying, wow, how could you do that? How could you forgive? How could you admit you were wrong? I mean, you weren't as wrong as he was. How could you do that? And people are puzzled. They're mystified when Christians are living out the gospel and reflecting the compassion of Christ. I did a case here in California many years ago. It was a case of some very, very terrible conduct on the part of a pastor and then a cover-up by the church involved in the case. It ended up in a $200 million lawsuit against the pastor, the district president. They had four different levels in this denomination. They were also self-insured, so they were on the hook for the same whole amount. We got this into mediation. The case had gone on for 4 years in litigation. They'd spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in litigation. Finally got them into a mediation process where they committed to mediate, if necessary, arbitrate it. And two days of very intense mediation, 16-hour days. I mean, just all sorts of sin coming out, people angry, bitter, blaming, accusing, threatening. Everybody was right in their own eyes, and everybody else was as wrong as they could be. It was just horrible. The basic situation was a couple had come to a pastor with marital problems and just lots of problems in their family. They had two children, recently had a new baby, and just the actual stress, additional stress. And the end of the counseling process was that they ended up deciding to place their new baby for adoption to solve the stress in their marriage. And what made it worse was the pastor said his son and daughter-in-law couldn't have children. They make great parents, and so why don't you adopt your child to my son? I mean, a terrible breach of a fiduciary responsibility, using his position of influence to basically take their child. Now, the pastor was absolutely adamant that it wasn't his idea. He tried to talk them out of it. They insisted. They initiated it, everything else. He was adamant in that. They were adamant that it was his idea. He suggested it. He encouraged it. He promoted it. And they were convinced the other side was lying. And the thing I found is when people have a conflict that's gone on for 4 years and they tell their version of the story over and over and over again, they pretty soon can't remember the truth. They only know their version of the fact. So they're sincerely telling what they think is true, even though it may be very distorted. So it turned in this huge lawsuit, and the denomination was involved because they had actually moved the young couple, who was also a pastor in the denomination, the adoptive parents, they moved them to another location and concealed their location. So now it looked like a conspiracy. Well, to make a long story short, we got into mediation, a few days of incredible prayer and counsel and everything else, and there was this huge breakthrough. The Holy Spirit just began to move in very dramatic ways of bringing people to a point of repentance, of seeing the logs in their own eyes. And at one point, the couple, they kept trying to get the child back. They're still fighting for custody, even though because of statutory period run, there was no legal way to regain custody. But they were still just so frustrated and pursuing. And in a private meeting with the birth parents, I asked the mother, I said, now, your daughter, who was 3 months old when you adopted her, has been with this couple for 4 years. They're good people. You can see that. They love her. They care. Is it really a loving thing to try to take her back? And she acknowledged it wasn't. I said, why do you keep pursuing her? Why do you keep pressing that part of this? And she said, I'm afraid that someday when I meet her, if I stop pursuing her, she'll someday think I didn't love her. So it was a fear that someday this little daughter would think mom didn't love me enough to keep fighting for me that kept driving the mother to do something that's very destructive. And she and the husband finally began to realize that was not a healthy thing to do. So we went into the meeting, and they both said that, you know, as we prayed about it, thought about it, we want you to know that we're not going to make any further attempts to regain custody of our daughter. In fact, we would like to bless you as her parents. Well, the room just dissolved in tears. The adoptive parents have been living in fear for 4 years. So there's this big breakthrough. We had a recess, came back in, started up again, and then suddenly, without any warning, the pastor got up, walked across the room, got down on his knees, totally freaked out his attorney. This is not something attorneys like to see their clients do, especially when you're being sued for $200 million. And got down and just made this incredible confession. And he said, you know, I honestly, to the best of my ability, do not recall initiating this adoption. As far as I can recall, it was your idea. But I may be mistaken in that. I may be deceiving myself. But even if my version is true, I failed you as a pastor. I never should have allowed this to happen. I never should have been part of it. You needed a shepherd who was caring for you, looking out for you. I failed. I sinned against you. Please forgive me. This was their longing for, because they felt like their own pastor had betrayed them. And it was just very dramatic. At that point, the president of the denomination got up to, without any coaching or forewarning to me, and he did the same thing. Well, the room, just at that point, everybody's crying so much. I had 8 attorneys in that room, and half of them were non-believers. I called a recess, went out in the hallway, and there was an attorney who was representing one of the defendants, and I knew he was not a Christian. He'd made that very clear. And he was looking out the window, and he was trembling. And I walked up beside him, and he had tears running down his cheeks. And I said, Bruce, are you okay? And he said, what is going on in that room? There's a power in that room. If there's one thing attorneys respect, it's power. We all do. And I love it when I would always prefer to have non-Christian attorneys in a mediation process. The believing attorneys don't need to see this. The non-Christian attorneys do. And I love it when they finally see this display of God's grace, His compassion, His mercy, His transforming power, and they say, what is going on? And I say, what's going on? Jesus Christ is going on. The Redeemer, the Peacemaker, the Savior. And they resolved that whole thing just got resolved in a very dramatic way at the end of it. And there was a reconciliation of all the parties. They were restored to their church. It was a powerful display of the glory of God. So one of the most important things you do when you're coaching somebody in conflict is give them this vision. They are on display. They are like a mirror. And God's glory can shine off of them to everybody involved in that conflict. Everybody who's watching them can see the character of Christ. The other thing, the other G's we need to look at here is getting a log out of your own eye, is how do we deal with what's going on in our own heart? A lot of the teaching you receive through IBCD, CCF was so much easier. A lot of it focuses on the whole idea of idolatry. Elise has got a great new book on idolatry and the gospel. In fact, previous book on idolatry and the gospel. But this concept of how good desires can grow into consuming demands is so important for peacemaking. Because most of the conflicts we will deal with in our circles are not going to be overt, patently sinful, you know, a drug dealer trying to murder people. It's going to be people who have good things, but they want them too much. They're good goods that have become bad gods. It can be someone in a marriage, a man who wants to succeed in his career, and he's pouring all of his time and passion into his job and neglecting his marriage and his children. So this good desire to be successful, serve his boss well, becomes a consuming god, and it twists him, it gets a control of him. And so understanding how a good thing develops into an idol, or a desire to be a good employee, a desire to be a good mother, becomes a demand. This is my consuming thing. I'm not satisfied unless I'm successful at it. And then pretty soon I judge people who stand in my way, who don't support me, and I find them to be wrong, and then I punish them. I find ways to put pressure on people who are somehow not supporting me in this goal I have. And there's many illustrations I can give you, but it's a key thing to keep your eye out for is how good desires begin to control people and how they need to move backwards down this progression and say, what good thing is controlling me? What am I looking to apart from God or in place of God for fulfillment, security, safety, what have you. Once we identify what's going on in our heart, we need to make a confession to the other person. And this is where we use something we call the seven A's of confession. And it's spelled out in your manual here. Just seven basic principles that you can guide people through. Now, I want to caution you. Don't let people turn this into a pharisaical checklist. I've gone to my wife at times and given her a nice little 7A confession, and she's looked at me and she says, I don't think you meant a word of that. I had all the right words, but my heart was very cold and mechanical. I've had to go back and say, honey, you're right. And just a few words sincerely spoken is better than a speech that's technically laid out that we don't mean. But I have also worked with many people who needed to get into this kind of detail to realize, who is it I need to talk to? How do I deal with what's going on in my heart? How can I acknowledge how I've impacted and hurt this other person so they really know I understand that? How can I accept the consequence of this choice? What things I need to bear, make restitution, correct gossip, realize that it's going to be a while before you can trust me again, and I need to live with that. How can I alter my behavior by God's grace and then finally ask for forgiveness? And I've seen situations, cases headed for divorce, business is about to be dissolved, where someone making a sincere, heartfelt, genuine, spirit-led confession turns the whole thing upside down. Suddenly people are saying, wow, something is going on here that's dramatic. Now, after that, we have this issue of gently restoring. How do we go to the other person and help them to see their role in the conflict? Teaching people overlook minor offenses. There's a lot of passages in the Bible. There's many things we should have a very thick skin on, not make a big deal out of. And there's many offenses, the vast majority of them we experience every day, can be just put under the grace of God and say, God is merciful, compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in love. Let me be the same way. And it's putting on this character of Christ. But sometimes there's issues that are too serious to overlook, and so how do we go to that brother or sister? Like the story I told last night, a brother coming to me. He saw me telling a joke that was offending and embarrassing my wife, and he loved me so much. He came to me. And when we go to people, we want to breathe grace to them. It's an expression we use on a way to communicate that, how do I communicate to you something I think that needs correction in your life? I do it the same way God communicates to me, graciously and lovingly. So it's like we breathe in God's grace, His love, His compassion, the essence of the gospel. As we speak to people, that's what comes out of our mouth, is the love and compassion of Christ as articulated in the gospel. There's many great examples in the Bible of this. John 4 is a superb example where Jesus, as he engages the woman at the well, it's interesting, most of what he talks about as he engages her is not her and her sin. He spends most of his time talking about God, who he is, what he's like, and what he's doing. And we focus on that, the character of God, the nature of God, what he's done for us through Christ, who we are in Christ. It creates a safe environment where we often see people responding, like the woman at the well. She starts to open up and share her need. And then this whole issue of keeping things as private as possible, but involving others if we need to. The whole issue of church engagement, mediation, and so on. And then finally, I'm not going to spend time on this because I know you've had a lot of training on forgiveness, but teaching people how to forgive, make specific promises, understanding what forgiveness is not and what it should be, is vitally important. And I've just talked to a lot of people in situations, an adultery case for one example, where a man, he was sorry for his sin. He knew his adultery, his affair was wrong. But he had no hope of forgiveness. And as I was counseling him and his wife, I saw him being very repentant. And I said, would you like your wife to forgive you? And he said, no. I said, I don't understand. You know what you did is wrong. You've admitted it, but you don't want her to forgive you? And he said, her forgiveness means nothing. When she says, I forgive you, all it means is she's going to drop it for the moment, but she's putting it in the file cabinet, and I will hear about it again and again and again. And he just had no hope that she would ever let go of his adultery. Even though he was repentant, he wanted to break off the relationship, restore the marriage, because of the way she had practiced forgiveness all of her life, he had no hope they could ever have a meaningful relationship. And so I talked to her about these concepts that forgiveness is really a series of promises we make in reliance on God's grace. I'm not going to dwell on this. I'm not going to bring it up and use it against you again. I'm not going to talk to other people. I'm not going to let it stand between us. As I shared those promises, this woman just dissolved in tears. And I asked her what was going on. She said, I could never keep those promises. And she saw that her whole life was a matter of holding on to grudges and holding things against people. And I said, I know you can't. I can't keep those promises. Not my own strength, but Christ in us. can, because those are the promises God makes to us, and He wants to give us the grace to imitate Him. And she saw she had only one desperate chance to redeem her marriage, was to take hold of Christ, to make those promises, not in her own strength, but in reliance on the grace of Jesus Christ. And they were able to do that. That marriage was reconciled. They had a lot of difficult counseling to go through, but they were restored. So sometimes just really understanding the true nature of forgiveness, how God-like it is, how God-dependent it is the key to finally bringing these relationships back together again. Well, I do want to encourage you to read the story that you found at the beginning of this section on page 15 and then on 18. It's a pretty dramatic story of how somebody in a church who learned just those very basic, simple principles saved the careers of two scientists in her business and a multi-million dollar contract for her business and had multiple opportunities, people coming to her and saying, how did you do it? What did you do? She was witnessing in a large company by just bringing those very simple principles to some people in a major conflict. So read that story. It's a pretty dramatic story. So that's the end of this section.